A nighttime curfew is imposed in Washington, D.C. after U.S. President Donald Trump's supporters stormed Congress to block the certification of Joe Biden's presidential victory. U.S. police say a woman was shot and killed during clashes between security forces and protesters inside the Capitol. And Democrats take control of the U.S. Senate after winning two seats in the runoff elections in the state of Georgia. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in for World News. Our top story, U.S. House of Representatives and Senate have both gone into recess as President Donald Trump's supporters breached the Capitol building. U.S. Capitol building's on lockdown now, and congressional staffers and journalists have been ordered to shelter in place. Unexpected recess came as pro-Trump supporters clashed with Capitol police and forced their way into the building. Shots were then fired and tear gas deployed to control the crowd. Police said a woman was shot at the Capitol building there and has now died. You saw her laying on the ground there. National Guard was deployed to secure the building while Washington was placed under a nighttime curfew. Trump supporters gathered the nation's capital to protest the ratification of President-elect Joe Biden's Electoral College victory. In a video message, the outgoing president, who had himself called the rally, urged protesters to go home. U.S. President-elect Joe Biden has denounced Donald Trump's supporters' raid on the Capitol building as insurrection.
This is not dissent. It's disorder. It's chaos. It borders on sedition. And it must end now.
Biden also described the storming as an assault on U.S. democracy. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence called for an immediate end to the demonstrations. Republican U.S. Senator Mitt Romney said that Trump has caused what he called an insurrection. House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy also called the protests un-American. Several lawmakers from both parties denounced the president for what they call inciting a coup. Moreover, former U.S. President George W. Bush has drawn a comparison between the incident and how election results are disputed in a, quote, banana republic. Top officials from around the world have also condemned the storming of the U.S. Congress building by pro-Trump supporters. Let's take a listen.
In the eyes of the world, American democracy tonight appears under siege. This is an unseen assault on the U.S. democracy, its institutions, and the rule of law. This is not America. The election results of the 3rd of November must be fully respected.
Disgraceful scenes in U.S. Congress. The United States stands for democracy around the world, and it is now vital that there should be a peaceful and orderly transfer of power.
The violent acts against American institutions are a grave attack against democracy. I condemn them. The American people's will and vote must be respected.
Shocking scenes in Washington, D.C. The outcome of this democratic election must be respected.
Deeply concerned by violence at the Capitol in Washington, D.C. and the interruption of the democratic process in the UN's host country.
Political commentator Kayla Pupuche says that most U.S. Republicans do not support what Donald Trump and his followers are doing.
Actually, I do think that the Republicans, a majority of them still side with them. They are part of the rule. And the ruling class is not going to concede their power. The Republicans, the Democrats, they are united in one issue that is maintaining capitalism. It's maintaining this liberal, democratic, capitalist country. Whereas those who are storming the Capitol right now, those who are calling for recounting the votes, calling this the Steal the Vote campaign, those are on the far right that would rather overthrow the government and establish their own fascistic far-right government that is not in line with the interests of the ruling class that we have now. So I do believe that despite the fact that the Democrats are going to have a majority, they're not that far off from the Republicans, and what they are interested in, what they are both interested in, is maintaining a liberal capitalist hegemony both in the United States and in the globe. But the far right and Donald Trump and that camp of Republicans, which Most Republicans are denouncing. Most Republicans are not in support of what him and his supporters are doing right now. So I think that the Senate will actually be more united, but those in the country, the people of this country, will be reaping the consequences between what is happening now and today.
Joining us now from New York is Brian Downing, national security analyst and political commentator. Hello, Brian. Your thoughts on what we saw today?
Well, I think what you saw was a very chaotic attack on democratic institutions. It could be called an insurrection. If the only reason I back off a little bit from that is because it was just so chaotic, poorly led. They wouldn't have known what to do if they had seized control of the Capitol. What's going on in the near future? That's pretty hard to say. I think we will see, and I hope to see, an easing of conflict around Washington. But you could see it flare back on January 20th. However, I'm sure the inauguration will be very small scale, and it will be very well policed. There won't be people going after the Biden platform. They won't be able to get close. Further down the road, I think we've escalated the level of incivility, hostility, and violence in this country. We've seen it escalate a lot this year from both sides of the political spectrum. We could see attacks on politicians, on local politicians' offices. The media seemed to be singled out, not singled out, but they seemed to be targets. There was a lot of media people and their equipment were attacked on Capitol Hill today.
Syrian Air Defense Forces have repelled an act of Israeli aggression in the south of the country. Syrian military spokesman said missiles flying over the Golan Heights targeted several locations in the southern areas of Damascus. Syrian forces fired surface-to-air missiles toward and intercepted the missiles. This is the third such attack in nearly 10 days. Last month, Israel launched a similar attack on Damascus, killing a soldier and three others. Recent upsurge in the number of Israeli attacks is seen as a reaction to the Syrian forces' success in battling foreign-backed terror groups seeking to topple the government of President Bashar al-Assad. Iran says it will not tolerate any interference in the country's missile and nuclear programs, as well as the nation's defense policy. Iran's foreign ministry spokesperson made the remarks after the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council issued a statement following a summit in Saudi Arabia, accusing Iran of destabilizing the region through its missile and nuclear programs. Said Khatibzadeh slammed the statement as baseless and repetitive with the aim of promoting Iranophobia. He also accused Saudi Arabia of holding other members of the council hostage and imposing its destructive ideas on them. Officials said the Riyadh is trying to cover up its own crimes in Yemen by playing a blame game. Iran says there are serious indications of Israel's role in the November assassination of top Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Defense Minister Amir Hatami has called the assassination an inhumane act, saying that Iran has the right to hold the perpetrators accountable. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed this issue in length with our guests. Here it is.
Iran's defense minister says that there is solid evidence of Israel's role in the November assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Amir Hatami said that Israeli intelligence services have a history of direct involvement in similar assassinations in Iran. He made the comments in separate messages to counterparts in 60 countries. The Iranian defense minister called Fakhrizadeh's assassination an inhumane act. He said that Iran has the right to hold the perpetrators accountable. Hatami argued that inaction would lead to the repeat of such incidents and insecurity. He also said the global fight against terrorism requires nations to refrain from double standards. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was killed in a terrorist attack near Tehran. Robert Fantina is an author and journalist joining us from Kitchener. We also have George Samueli, senior research fellow at Global Policy Institute. Okay, Robert Fantina, first over to you. Iran says that it's almost certain that there's Israeli connection, Israeli traces of the assassination that took place on Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Israel does have a history, even though it doesn't confirm nor deny that it has been involved in these acts in the past. Do you think that Israel was responsible for this assassination?
Yes, I think it's quite clear yet, but the evidence points that way. I think it's also interesting that Iran is taking a very deliberate looking at not simply making the accusation without evidence that they are gathering. This is the pattern that Israel has followed in assassinating people, scientists within Iran, scientists and others. It is clearly a violation of international law, and Mr. Hatami is absolutely right in saying that the perpetrators, and it's probably Israel, must be held accountable.
So, George Samueli, what can Iran do then if it has the evidence that it needs, if it has the information that it needs against Israel, and that it shows that there was Israeli involvement in this assassination? What steps can Iran take?
Well, that's a very good question, because the steps that Iran can take are very limited. Iran is a signatory of the International Criminal Court, but Iran has never ratified the statute of the International Criminal Court. The same goes for Israel, also a signatory, but never ratified it. So the ICC route really isn't open to Iran. Now, Iran could apply for an Interpol arrest warrant if it has some ideas of who had planned it, or who were the perpetrators. But it's unlikely that Interpol would act on an arrest warrant requested by Iran. So that's not really a very good route. Now, Iran could take direct action and maybe act in some violent way towards Israel, whether through another assassination or some kind of a military attack. It has, but that, of course, has repercussions, because then Israel is likely to retaliate, or the United States is likely to retaliate. So it's an unfortunate aspect of international affairs that you can do these obviously illegal things, which is assassinating scientists, assassinating military and political leaders of countries that you're not actually at war with, and you don't really have that many options to retaliate without serious consequences for yourself down the road.
Well, I mean, this sounds like it's a movie plot in a sense for Robert Fantino. When you take a look at some of the details there that George Samueli has given, it's like the Wild Wild West in a sense. I mean, you have Iran being the, you know, the one that unfortunately has had this nuclear scientist to have been assassinated. You have the Iranian Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani to have been killed as a result of a targeted assassination. What George Samueli said in terms of a reaction, where Iran has promised revenge for Soleimani in terms of Fakhrizadeh, there may be something in the works, we don't know. But that's exactly what needs to be prevented. And the only way to do that is to prosecute, or else you have nations deciding who their enemies are and then taking them out, political leaders, officials, etc. So some precedent has to be set here. How can that be done?
I think the main course open to Iran now is, as far as goodwill and on the international stage, these are two acts of violence that have been perpetrated against Iranian officials, one a scientist, and of course General Soleimani that you mentioned. And as your other commentator mentioned, a direct military hit against the United States or Israel would certainly cause cause a catastrophe within that part of the world. But these countries must be ostracized as the rogue regimes that they are, Israel and the United States. Both of them disdain international law. They hold human rights in contempt. They have no respect for human life at all, and that's why they are willing to do these targeted assassinations. It is tragic that there isn't a vehicle within the United Nations that would be workable in this case to bring this case to the United Nations and to have it prosecuted there. That doesn't currently exist in a real viable format at this point. But lacking that, then the other nations must be put on hold. It was said that Mr. Khatami had contacted 60 of his counterparts around the world. That's a very good thing. These other countries can perhaps take some action regarding trade, some kind of action against Israel that is not military in response to this assassination.
Thank you for that, Robert Fontina, author and journalist. And thank you, George Samueli, research, senior research fellow at Global Policy Institute. And that does it for our news review. Thanks for tuning in.
British police have made several arrests as protesters hit the streets of London ahead of a parliament vote on a new national lockdown measure announced by the government. Protests were held just outside Parliament, where Prime Minister Boris Johnson was defending his decision to implement the new lockdown. Johnson insists that the new coronavirus variant leaves him with no choice but to implement more restrictions to curb spread of the disease. UK has seen a steep rise in COVID cases in recent weeks. On Wednesday, the country reported over 62,000 infections, setting a daily record for new cases. It also recorded over 1,000 daily deaths for a first time since April. Elsewhere in Europe, Italy reported over 20,000 new cases and 548 new deaths in the past 24 hours. The country's overall caseload now stands at nearly 2.2 million and deaths at over 76,000. Turkey is struggling with a rising unemployment rate amid the coronavirus pandemic, and this comes despite the government's economic projects try to create more jobs for the young. Rashan Saglam reports.
Unemployment rates among Turkish youth have increased dramatically in the recent period, especially after the outbreak of the new coronavirus pandemic. According to the latest figures released by the Turkish Statistical Institute, the unemployment rate was 12.7% in September 2020. Turkish government says reviving economy is among its priorities amid the pandemic. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has vowed not to allow foreign factors negatively affect the country's economy.
It is not possible for a state to survive in long term with rising unemployment. So we have developed various plans to revive our economy, turning it into one of the 10 largest economies in the world by equal distribution of wealth among our population.
As part of efforts to stop declining employment, the government has banned companies from firing employees during the pandemic. So it prevents us from seeing the direct effect of the coronavirus on unemployment. We cannot see it in numbers, but we can definitely see it on the ground. This is how economists explain.
Unemployment is one of the biggest economic problems in the world, and Turkey is no exception. Despite our government's projects to lower the unemployment rates, unfortunately the numbers are rising, especially amid the pandemic that has paralyzed the economic sector.
The government says it plans to lower the unemployment rate to 10.9% in 2023. However, it seems that it all depends on how the country plans to recover from a pandemic and the lira crisis. As observers say, the main strength point of the ruling party has been flourishing economy and low unemployment. And now, with the pandemic continuing more and more, the country is witnessing the ruling party's popularity sliding further. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
That's it for your latest one. Thank you for joining me. Bye-bye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
The U.S. State Department has announced a flurry of deals, including $290 million in Boeing-made precision-guided bombs to Saudi Arabia, $65 million in drones and fighter jets to the UAE, $169 million in military equipment to Egypt, and $4 billion in helicopters to Kuwait. We have prepared an article for you in this regard, written by Kenny Stansfield Ryder. This article is published under the heading Lame Duck Trump's West Asia Arms Bonanza Continues with Approval of $290 Million Weapons Sales to Saudi Regime. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Despite opposition from the public and some members of U.S. Congress, the Trump administration, in its waning days, is rushing through weapons sales to a handful of West Asian nations with records of human rights abuses, including Saudi Arabian regime and the United Arab Emirates, whose U.S.-backed blockades and airstrikes have exacerbated civilian suffering and death in Yemen's ongoing war. The U.S. State Department announced a flurry of deals, including $290 million in Boeing-made precision-guided bombs to Saudi Arabia, $65 million in drones and fighter jets to the UAE, $169 million in military equipment to Egypt, and $4 billion in helicopters to Kuwait. President Trump's lame duck West Asia arms bonanza continues, said William Hartung, the director of the Arms and Security Program at the Center of International Policy. Selling more bombs to Saudi Arabia, given its history of indiscriminate airstrikes that have killed thousands of civilians in Yemen, should be a non-starter. While the actions of Saudi Arabia and UAE regimes have come under increased scrutiny as a result of the Saudi-led assault on Yemen, Hartung also encouraged Congress and Biden to review the sale of equipment to Egypt in light of its brutal and counterproductive counter-terror campaign in the Sinai, which has involved severe human rights abuses, the killing of innocent civilians, and the driving of thousands of families from their homes. As The Guardian reported, Joe Biden's transition team has complained that it is not being properly briefed by the Pentagon on ongoing military operations, as is customary for an incoming administration in the weeks preceding inauguration on January 20th. In an effort to impede the transfer of at least some weapons, the New York Center for Foreign Policy Affairs is reportedly planning to file a lawsuit against Secretary of State Mike Pompeo over the proposed deal with the UAE regime. The filing will claim the Trump administration has failed to meet the legal requirements of the Arms Export Control Act. For the deal to proceed, there must be a full rationale for the sale and consideration of the impact on U.S. security and world peace, the New Arab reported recently. The lawsuit also cites the UAE's actions in the Saudi-led air campaign in Yemen. Although the U.S. Senate in early December failed to block President Donald Trump's $23 billion weapons deal with the UAE regime, the lawsuit calls for an injunction to stop the sale. The Trump administration has attempted to justify selling arms to the UAE, The Guardian noted, by saying the weapons allow the country to deter increasing behavior and threats of other countries. According to a press release issued recently by Defense Security Cooperation Agency, the arms deal with Saudi Arabia will support U.S. foreign policy and national security objectives by helping to improve the security of a friendly country that continues to be an important force for political stability and economic growth in the West Asia region. Critics of the weapon sales, however, say the deals will worsen human rights violations and destabilize the West Asia region. As The Hill reported recently, the notice kicks off a 30-day clock during which lawmakers can block the sale if they choose to. If Congress can't block it, Hartung said, the Biden administration should do so when it takes office.
Iqbal, obviously being a scholar, we say him Allama Iqbal as well. He was a mystic. He knew Quran very well. In his poetry, we can see, you know, interpretation of Quran as well. So he basically was referring back towards the original Islam.
One very important factor about his character was that he was a concerned person. You know, he had the concerns for the society, for the people, for the human beings. He was a person who constantly thought about others and finding solutions for the betterness of the society and betterness of the world.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear brothers and sisters, all across the nation of Islam. This is The Teacher, an introduction to the lives and works of the most outstanding Muslim thinkers, philosophers, and scholars all across the world, with the presence of two experts from the Islamic House of Qom, Dr. Murtaza Rezazadeh and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome, and Dr. Rezazadeh, assalamu alaikum to you, and welcome to the show, brother.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for having me.
So, in this new series of the program, The Teacher, we are concerned with some of the outstanding and prominent Muslim thinkers and scholars. And for this episode, we have selected Muhammad Iqbal, who was a famous poet, scholar, and politician of India, now present Pakistan. And in fact, whose poetry and some of his works in politics were really outstanding, and his vision, in fact, of the independent states of the Muslims for British India was to inspire the creation of Pakistan at that time. And he's commonly referred to as Allama Iqbal, a polymath or a scholar. Okay, Dr. Rezazadeh, in our previous discussion regarding the Persian poetry of Iqbal Lahuri, you named two first important poetic collections of him for us, اسرار خودی and رموز بی خودی, secrets of the self and hints of selflessness. What are the other important poetic collections of Iqbal, and what are the main themes of his works for us?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The collections I mentioned, but the themes are remaining.
Yes, very good.
And, you know, it is really hard to mention or to name all the themes that he has talked about, because, as I said, you know, he has been one of the reformers of the Persian poetry in the sense of content and bringing a lot of new content into Persian poetry. He has composed more than 15,000 lines of poetry, that two-thirds of them are in Persian.
That's right.
So he has talked about a wide variety of different topics. But some of the major themes that I can mention here is that one of them is inviting to being intellectual, I mean, in using reason.
That's
and
right.
Being rational. So sometimes, although he wants us to be very, let's say, spiritual, but at the same time, he's not among those people who only promote a type of, let's say, remote lifestyle that
solitary
pays no attention.
Yeah. He is among the people, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, he talks about, he admires philosophy and wisdom and paying attention. حکمت و فلسفه را و همت مردی باید تیغ اندیشه به روی دو جهان آختن است. If you want to really become good in philosophy and wisdom,
right.
You really need to have the will of a very strong man. Mm-hmm. It's like having the sword of the, let's say, thought, mm-hmm. to draw your sword to the both worlds. Mm-hmm. He wants to say that
yes.
It's hard, but you really need to be a very strong in your intellect. And at the same time, another theme that we can mention is that he fights with a type of negative asceticism. You know, you can find it in the, this is very common
okay.
in the some of the Persian poets,
okay.
that when they talk about asceticism and not being, let's say, attached to this worldly life, mm-hmm. they say it in a way that the person becomes influenced and they think that this world, mm-hmm. this really material, physical world, has no role and no importance.
Oh.
But he talks in a more, let's say, comprehensive and
rational
yes,
way.
Rational
That's
way.
Right.
You see, at the same time, that should not be attached mm-hmm. to this world. You should know that asceticism, in its radical or excessive meaning, can be harmful, because it stops you from making this world and from your progress in this world.
That's right.
Also, another important is that he was a revolutionary person, and you
yes.
can see this in many of his works. He invites people to work and hard work. I will mention
okay.
some of his poetry in
Very
this
good.
Regard. And also, let's say, looking for freedom.
Mm-hmm.
In some of his poetry, he
That's
says,
right.
you know, what I'm doing is to break the chains
mm-hmm.
Of my existence. I want to break all the chains and all the, let's say, elusive chains
That's right.
that people have made around
Do
themselves.
Do you have any sample of his Persian poems in this regard?
For example, باز آمدم چو اید نو تا قفل زندان بشکنم وین چرخ مردم خار را و چنگال و دندان بشکنم. He has a lot about this.
Okay.
This is just one simple. He says, I just came back, just like a new day, like
mm-hmm.
a new Eid,
yes.
a new holiday,
yes.
to break the lock of this prison. وین چرخ مردم خار را چنگال و دندان بشکنم and also break
mm-hmm.
the teeth of this
cruel
killer or cruel
yes, that's right.
devil
that's right
so devils. He wants to just, you know, encourage people
okay.
to free themselves from all the things that
okay.
stops them
mm-hmm. we'll get
another,
the terms today if possible
okay sure
get to
no
say
problem.
Most and now we
okay.
just we can't say and some audio but before that I would like to say that, as Dr. Reza Zadeh said, this rational look that he had at the world, and also some of the content that is very much rare found nowadays in the Persian poetry and in the classical one also, is looking for a savior and peace in the world. This was Iqbal Lahori was looking for. In one of the outstanding Persian poems, he talks about Savar-e Ashhab. In fact, Ashhab is a kind of, we can say, gray horse, a gray-colored horse. And it says that, A savar ashhab doran bia, a furugh dide emkan bia, ronagh hengame ijad sho, dar savad dide ha abad sho. Shoresh aqvam ra khamush kon, naghme khod ra behesht goosh kon. Khiz o qanun ukhuvvat sazde, jam sahbaye mohabbat bazde. He's talking about the last savior, and we can say about coming of a savior in order to find peace. And Jang Juyan Rao Bede Peigham Sulh, give the message of peace to the warriors, and then we can say to the war takers in the world. Really beautiful content in Farsi language, which was manifested by him. Do we have such content in the Urdu language too, Sayyid Mohsen?
Well, his Urdu works, I said, like, it's divided into the awaking position and then shaking people, and then after that, the system that we want. Yes. In Zarbe Kalim that we mentioned, he's talking about the Islamic system. First of all, what he does is he talks about the democracy. He says, "Is raaz ko ek mard farangi ne kiya faash, har chand ke dana is khola nahi karte. Jamhuriyat ek tarz hukumat hai ke jisme bando ko gina karte hain, tola nahi karte."
Okay.
It means that he said, like, one of the people in the West, they told me the secret.
That's right.
They opened the secret for me, which usually the wise people, they don't open their secrets, but he opened his secret in front of me.
Okay.
And he said, democracy system, the democrat system, Jamhuriyat.
Yes.
The democracy.
Okay.
In this system, it's a kind of a system in which they count people, they do not weight people. You know, we know that a person is weighted because of his education,
that's right,
his wisdom, his insights, his basira, and all those things.
Okay.
He said, remember, the Jamhuriyat, the democracy, is a kind of thing in which people are counted, they're not weighted.
Okay.
And on top of that, in the same book, he mentions about the concept of imama. He says, "Tu ne puchi hai imamat ki haqiqat mujhse, haq tujhe meri tarah sahib asrar kare." You have asked me about the concept of imamat. What is imamat?
That's
that
right.
I'm talking about the imam and ummat.
Mm-hmm.
May Allah make you the bearer of the secret like me.
Okay.
And the imam, and then he describes the imam. Who is the imam, basically, what he was talking. Hai wohi tere zamane ka imam barhaq. He is your imam, the true imam, jo tujhe hazir o mawjood se bezar kare. Who disgusted you from what you are in, you know, the current situation that you are living in.
That's right.
The current situation, for example,
awakening, in fact. This
he's basically awakening.
That's
the imam, the role of imam is to awaken. He is a revolutionary person. I just remember of the, you know, the statement that the supreme leader has said.
Yes.
Man inqalabi.
Yes.
He's basically talking about the same concept.
I am revolutionary.
I'm revolutionary.
That's right.
So I'm here to awaken you, and you need to go towards the revolution.
These are some of the secrets of the Iqbal's poem that were welcomed before the Islamic Revolution of Iran. And we know that in the literary circles and among the revolutionary circles and by the leaders of the Islamic Revolution, the poems of Iqbal were very much welcomed.
Yes.
Because he was after establishing a separate Muslim land and reviving the pure Muhammadan Islam. This was why maybe his poems were very much welcomed. And regarding what Imam said, he has a beautiful poem regarding Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Yes.
He says, "Muslim avval shah mardan Ali, ish ra sarmaye iman Ali, az belay dudmanash zindam, dar jahan misl gohar tabandam." In fact, he's referring to Imam Ali alayhi salam and the dudman. In fact, the descendants of Imam Ali alayhi salam, I am alive by them. He had really beautiful poems regarding religious content. He was, as they say, we know that in the literature, we have literature of commitment, adabiyat ta'ahud, okay? He was really a committed man, in fact, a person who was faithful to his beliefs in his poetry too.
Exactly.
Okay, Dr. Zazadeh, any other points regarding the themes of the Persian poems?
Yes, there are a few others that I wanted to mention. One is just what you just mentioned. You know, we can say that Iqbal's poetry has one feature that we can call it religiosity while being intellectual.
Oh.
You know, this is something very important for him. He wanted to prove and he wanted to explain in his poetry that you can, of course, be a very good, committed, faithful person while at the same time being a very intellectual person. And he proved it and he expressed it in the best way in his poetry. That you mentioned some of the examples, so I don't bring examples. Another one that is very common in his poetry is relying on the self. He really wanted to make the younger generation aware of the, as I mentioned in the previous episode, aware of their own havings and the treasures that they have. And he brings some beautiful metaphors. For example, he explains the life, or let's say He defines the life in this way. In his poetry, he says, زندگی در صدف خیش گوهر ساختن است، در دل شعله فرو رفتن و نگداختن است. At the same time that this is revolutionary, this really gives a lot of self-confidence to the person who reads it. He says, life is like making your own jewel in your own shell.
Right.
So you really need to bear with all the difficulties and make your own jewel while you are in your own shell. And he uses beautiful metaphor. در دل شعله فرو رفتن و نگداختن است. And life is also going into the heart of the
fire.
Okay. And at the same time not being burned by that.
This reminds me of Ibrahim, the story
That's a good point. Yeah.
Okay. So the allegory is like that. Okay.
Appreciate what you have. And this is one of, let's say, his most important messages to the Muslim nations
Very
who
good.
Came. I hope I have time to also mention a couple of other themes because they are really important.
Okay.
I think it's a pity not to mention them.
Okay, we got about 1 minute for you, brother. Okay.
So let's stop
here. Yeah, Iqbal has much to say.
Yeah.
Iqbal has much to say.
Let me just mention the titles that I had some explanations maybe later.
Okay.
But this is really what we need even until today. Mm-hmm. He wanted to give a realistic view to the West, especially to the youth.
Okay.
So that they know what is the reality of the West,
That's
what
right.
is the cause and the reason of their power, and what is their weak point, in order to give you a good view, and let's say in order not to be spelled by the Western culture. He had beautiful poetry. I wish I had time to
That's right.
recite some of that. And then the last one that I wanted to mention is his invitation to hard work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can find it very much in his
That's
poetry.
Right.
And he says, ساحل افتاده گفت گرچه بسی زیستم هیچ نمعلوم گشت آه که من کیستم موجز خود رفته ای تیز خرامید و گفت هستم اگر میروم گر نروم نیستم. This reminds
wow.
me of the Sa'di poetry.
Wow.
This is very similar to it. And he says, ساحل افتاده, you know, the seashore. This is a metaphorical
yes.
dialogue between the seashore and the wave
and
of the sea.
And the wave that touches it.
Yeah,
okay.
yeah, exactly. The
okay.
seashore that is very stable, does
stable.
Not go anywhere.
Fixed,
yeah,
yes.
it's fixed and
yes.
it's very stable.
Okay.
Said, although I lived a lot, maybe for centuries, but still, I don't know, I wonder who I am.
Okay.
And then,
the wave
sea
says,
wave
okay.
that passed very fast said, in answer
okay.
to the sure, hastam agar miravam gar naravam nistam. I exist if I keep going. I will be non-existent if I stop.
Okay.
You know, that's really inspiring.
Yeah.
It's really
the power forward to
yeah.
move forward.
Yeah, encourages
really,
you to
yeah.
move forward and never stop, because as soon as you
okay.
stop, you will be non-existent.
Nice message for our young generation nowadays, young generation, young Muslims. If you wanna advance,
Keep
never
going.
Stop, go forward, and then you can change current situation. It was very kind of you,
Absolutely.
Dr. Reza Zadeh and Said Mohsen Naqvi. We do not have more time in order to get to the other aspects of the life of Allama Iqbal Rahoui. He says, گرچه هندی در عذوبت شکر است، طرز گفتار دری شیرین تر است. Although the Hindi language is sweet, but you know, the way of expressing yourself and poets in Farsi language
is sweeter.
That's right. And this was why Allama Iqbal Lahori composed most of his poems in the Farsi and Persian language. Thank you much, Dr. Reza Zadeh and Said Mohsen Naqvi, and dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program The Teacher, which was about Allama Muhammad Iqbal Lahori. May Allah bless him and bless his soul. He was really a great man. And I think that some of the courses, at least at the universities, have to be dedicated to Iqbal Shenasi, like Iqbal studies,
yes.
like the other thing. This is my suggestion in the program, The Teacher, for our students and for our dear professors of Muslim lands, in order to introduce these dignitaries. And even they could have their own separate departments, because now we could see in the Western world, most of the philosophers have their own studies, have their own students, have their own generation of the books produced. Okay, over there, Iqbal Lahori is for sure among the first ones who should be studied more, and in different aspects, political, social, and also literary style. Do not forget to visit our website, parstoday.com/Iqbal Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you. Al-Fiyam Allah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight. England will enter its toughest nationwide lockdown since March, with schools closed until mid-February, as Prime Minister Boris Johnson warned that the weeks ahead will be the hardest yet. As new figures put the United Kingdom on course to exceed 100,000 COVID-related deaths before the end of the month without urgent action, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson said once again that people must stay at home, with exercise limited to once a day. All non-essential shops were told to close from Monday night. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Jessica Elgott and Peter Walker. The piece is titled, England to Enter Toughest COVID Lockdown Since March. Stay with us for more of Jessica Elgott and Peter Walker's article. England will enter its toughest nationwide lockdown since March, with schools closed until mid-February, as Prime Minister Boris Johnson warned that the weeks ahead will be the hardest yet. As new figures put the United Kingdom on course to exceed 100,000 COVID-related deaths before the end of the month without urgent action, the Prime Minister said once again that people must stay at home, with exercise limited to once a day. All non-essential shops were told to close from Monday night. The lockdown will last for at least 7 weeks, with measures to be reviewed during half-term week. Any relaxation would not come into effect before 22nd of February. Just a day after urging millions of school pupils to return to the classroom, Boris Johnson announced all schools would switch to remote learning until the February half-term, and GCSE and A-level exams were unlikely to go ahead as planned. The Prime Minister said parents would reasonably ask why we did not make this decision sooner, adding, "I completely understand the inconvenience and distress this late change will cause millions of parents and pupils up and down the country." In an 8 p.m. address to the nation, the Prime Minister said he hoped that 12.2 million of the most vulnerable in society, care home residents and staff, frontline healthcare workers and social care workers, all those over the age of 70 and the clinically extremely vulnerable, would get their first vaccinations by mid-February. The Vaccines Minister, Nadeem Zahawi, later said these four groups added up to 13.9 million people in England. The United Kingdom was entering the last phase of the struggle, Boris Johnson said, adding, "With every jab that goes into our arms, we are tilting the odds against COVID and in favour of the British people." The crackdown comes amid catastrophic figures for hospital admissions in England and warnings of a grim death toll by the end of the month. Prime Minister Boris Johnson said, on 4th of January, there were 26,626 COVID patients in hospital in England, up 30% from a week earlier. The peak of admissions in the first wave was 18,374 on 12th of April. The country is now 40% above that level. Across the United Kingdom, there were 80,664 positive tests on 29th of December, with the case rate three times higher than the start of December. There have been 91,453 deaths in the United Kingdom with COVID-19 on the death certificate or within 28 days of a positive test. Given the current trajectory, the United Kingdom could reach the grim milestone of 100,000 deaths before the end of the month, according to experts. On Monday, 4th of January, the United Kingdom's chief medical officers recommended that the COVID alert move to its highest level from Tier 4 to Tier 5, meaning there is a material risk of healthcare services being overwhelmed and necessitating extremely strict social distancing. "We are not confident that the National Health Service can handle a further sustained rise in cases, and without further action, there is a material risk of the NHS in several areas being overwhelmed over the next 21 days. The chief medical officers of the four nations said, whilst urging those who still need emergency care for other illnesses to seek treatment. Other UK leaders also announced new restrictions. All schools in Wales will be closed until at least 18th of January, while mainland Scotland will be placed in full lockdown from midnight on Monday for the duration of January. Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, said it was no exaggeration to say that I'm more concerned about the situation we face now than I have been at any time since March last year. Northern Ireland also looks set for new curbs, with Arlene Foster, the First Minister of Northern Ireland, saying the region faces a very dire situation. In his address to the nation, Boris Johnson laid the blame for the third national lockdown squarely on a new, faster-spreading variant of the coronavirus, despite widespread ongoing criticism of the government's slowness to act. "There is no doubt that in fighting the old variant of the virus, our collective efforts were working and would have continued to work," Boris Johnson said. "But we now have a new variant of the virus. It has been both frustrating and alarming to see the speed with which this new variant is spreading." Even in the past 36 hours, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson had insisted that schools were safe to open in most areas of England. "There is no doubt in my mind that schools are safe," he told BBC's Andrew Moore on Sunday. However, the Prime Minister was unable to identify what he believed had changed since the preceding days, when most schools had been told to remain open, only saying in his address that schools were likely to act as vectors for transmission, causing the coronavirus to spread between households. Under the new lockdown, people in England will be ordered to stay at home from Tuesday and advised to leave only once a day for exercise. MPs are expected to vote the tough new measure into law from Wednesday, although businesses were advised to close from Monday night, 4th of January. Across the country, people must now leave home only for work, and only if it is impossible to work from home, and for essential food and medicine. Exercise with one other person from a different household is permitted, but the advice is to stay local and limit activity to just once a day. Other reasons to leave home will be limited to seeking medical care, fleeing the threat of harm, and providing essential care. All primary schools, all secondary schools and colleges will be closed apart from the children of key workers and vulnerable children. "We recognize that this will mean it is not possible or fair for all exams to go ahead this summer as normal," Boris Johnson said. The Education Secretary will work with Ofqual, the regulator, to put in place alternative arrangements. Nurseries, alternative provision and special schools will remain open, and existing rules for childcare support bubbles will continue. But students will not be able to return to university and will be expected to study online from their current residence until mid-February. In-person teaching can take place for a limited number of critical courses such as medicine. All non-essential retail and hospitality must close or remain closed. Restaurants and other premises will continue to offer deliveries or takeaways, but alcohol will no longer be permitted for takeaway or click and collect amid concerns about people congregating around bars. Places of worship can remain open and offer communal worship, subject to social distancing, as can playgrounds, but outdoor sports venues, tennis courts and golf courses must close. Outdoor team sports will not be permitted, but professional sports, including the Premier League, may continue.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.